Folks, this episode is being brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integration with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere.
I'm here for a good time, not a long time, you know, I haven't had a good time in a long time, you know, I'm way up, I feel blessed. Way up, I feel blessed.
Straight up.
I'm way up, I feel blessed.
Straight up.
Way up, I feel blessed.
I ain't gonna say that we back or nothing, cause that implies that we're back from something.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today's episode is about small events, little half-assed token expressions of free will that cause slightly less tiny waves that ripple out and end in giant global historical changes that get their own chapters and occasionally years in history class. And it can be hard to see how random and arbitrary history can be because we see through a brain that is specifically built to take everything in stride. Our ability to adapt to completely insane new circumstances is how we end up living on all the continents with penguins and desert lizards, I guess. You know, they have bodies adapted for those environments. We have minds that can get used to just the most unpleasant, shitty circumstances. So I was thinking about what to say in this introduction while watching Wes Anderson's latest movie, Grand Budapest Hotel, because I'm a multitasker. I'm actually researching an upcoming episode of After Hours that started with the Cheers theory I mentioned on the Live After Hours podcast, if you listen to that. But anyways, if you haven't seen it, the Grand Boops Hotz jumps around in time, but there's an early scene that takes place in 1968 where a man starts choking and Jason Schwartzman performs the Heimlich maneuver, which seems like the most normal thing in the world. But as a fan of podcasts, I'd heard the episode of Radiolab in which they interview Henry Heimlich, Dr. Henry Heimlich, the inventor of said maneuver, and he recounts having invented it and made it popular in a 1974 issue of Emergency Medicine, which I found shocking, not only that you could make something popular in Emergency Medicine magazine, but because the Heimlich maneuver seems like something that we've always had, that we've always known about. And I don't point that out only to be pedantic and shitty. Historical inaccuracy is probably the right answer when historical accuracy would involve everyone just standing around watching a guy choke to death. But I point it out as an example of a side effect of our super adaptable minds that we often don't notice. We adapt not just to inhospitable climates, but to new realities. New things come along that nobody could have imagined last year, and we just take them for granted, and they become part of our reality, and we don't really think about it. For instance, we'll talk in this episode about how the inventor of mobile phone technology, Martin Cooper, credits Star Trek for giving him the idea, and Daniel O'Brien, young, innocent Daniel, my nickname for him, still finding its footing around the office. But young, innocent Daniel finds that notion kind of insane because, for instance, the walkie-talkie has been around since Vietnam, at least. But when I was growing up, yes, wireless technology existed in the form of walkie-talkies and cordless phones, so long as there wasn't some tree or person or any noun of any substance between you and the other receiver. And there were people who were rich enough to turn their car or backpack or ground control in Houston into big enough wireless receivers. But the idea that we would all be walking around with tiny transponder devices in our pockets that could also get all of the world news was insane. Dan's right, walkie-talkies were the first iteration of mobile technology, but we took that invention so seriously we named it walkie-talkie. That was named by someone who thought its cultural impact was, I'd say, best case scenario on par with the speak and spell, which actually might give it too much credit since it wasn't called the speaky spelly. But these things that seem obvious and like foregone conclusions in retrospect are totally unnecessary products of thousands of different forces and accidents and coincidences blending together. Look at the version of 2015 and Back to the Future 2. They guessed that we'd have flying cars and shoes that tied themselves and incredible innovations in skateboard technology, but that we'd still make phone calls in phone booths or phones that still had to be plugged into a wire that curlicued parachute into the wall and then dove underground and met up with the just stressful tangle of wires, spider webbing, back and forth, and telephone poles. And that's what Hollywood gambled millions of dollars that people would find plausible. But the real version, our world, the real version of 2015 is just as far-fetched when you think about it. Maybe more. Would you take their overactive holographic displays and drives to work where you can get T-boned from above over the ability to have this podcast in your pocket? So that wide openness of the future and the idea that it can be influenced by just the stupidest and most half-assed of actions is one of the ideas we're talking about, and I think a good one to keep in mind from the start. Hope you enjoy it, and I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Blessings on blessings on blessings. Look at my life, man. That's lessons on lessons on lessons. I treat the beat like it's a reverend. I tell the truth like, Father, forgive me. These are all my confessions, man. This wasn't luck, it was destined. I done lost homies who been with me since Ed, Ed, and Eddie, who flip like confetti. And then when you back, they back to call you dog. That shit could get petty. Bitch, don't get no dap to me, nigga. Funny thing about talking behind my back is that it just keep coming back to me, nigga. Was off for a sec, now it's back to me, nigga. You mad at me?
All right, enough want, fucking fun, guys. Enough funning around.
Isn't that's the podcast slogan, right?
Yeah, enough fun, guys.
Enough fucking fun. It's time for the Cracked Podcast.
I'm joined by Michael Swaim, co-host.
Sorry.
Occasional co-host.
Still chewing that piece of caramel Dan gave me to sabotage me.
And Dan O'Brien. Sometimes guest.
Hello.
The Cracked Podcast. How's it going, guys?
It's going great. It's great to be here.
Oh, my God.
Long
so
time
good.
Listener, first time occasional co-host.
That's not even true.
How could it be?
So today we're talking about tiny little events that have huge rippling consequences across history or lives. Or there's that kind of cliched thing at this point. It's a cliche, I think, after something, an idea gets turned into an Ashton Kutcher film, it becomes officially a cliche, called the butterfly effect, where it's the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world can create, you know, hurricanes or typhoons in another part of the world. I think the scientist who first said it was smart enough to give specific geographical locations to really drive the point home. But, you know, I can't be expected to be as eloquent as a scientist, so I've forgotten that. But I know the story of how that theory came about, and it was actually a guy had created a weather machine that you could put enough, it was basically a computer that you could put all the coordinates of the weather at any given moment into it. The idea behind this machine was, oh, if you just feed enough data into this machine, you will be able to tell what the weather's going to be tomorrow and hundreds of years into the future because we have so much data. And at a certain point, he realized that you can never have enough data. One little random thing can happen that will throw off the weather pattern quickly. Tomorrow's weather is going to change, even though you have Doppler radars telling you exactly what the weather has been for the past 12 hours.
Right. And when the system's so complicated like that, like right. Something like weather or the proper nutritional balance of a human body, it's you can only guess no matter how much data you're given.
Yeah, and I think everything is complicated like that. There's nothing
that's... If you pay attention closely
right,
enough,
if you,
yeah.
Exactly. Like, an example that we might have mentioned on a past episode is this study that was done into the 26 biggest stock markets in the world over a 16-year period and found that one of the largest indicators of what the activity would be at any given time was whether it was sunny or not. So that butterfly flapping its wings, like the typhoon thing seems like a drama queen example. Like, I'm sure there aren't that many butterflies
no, I
that
get
have
it.
Caused
the
typhoons.
You're blaming the butterflies for the recession. I
right.
see where you're going
But you
with
actually
this.
Could blame them for the recession because cloud cover is probably very susceptible yeah. to the whims of butterfly wings.
Quit flapping your damn wings
yeah.
in this economy.
This podcast is about... We should just wipe out all the butterflies.
Out the butterflies. Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
yeah, it's specific to butterflies.
Also, yeah,
absolutely.
That was the point of the butterfly effect, was typhoons and hurricanes only come from
only butterflies.
Butterflies.
Yeah, so if we get rid of them, we'll be able to predict the weather.
And there's no positive wing flapping. It's no. all dark, the darkness of the butterfly.
I would love it if I finally watched that Ashton Kutcher movie and like that was the thing. It was like the butterfly effect. We got to kill all the butterflies,
oh, yeah,
you
guys. The post-credits scene in that was a butterfly on the phone with the president. Just like, very good.
Yeah, and there are kind of examples of this sort of thing all over the place that don't involve just butterfly wings that I wanted to talk about with you guys.
They are all supposed to involve Ashton Kutcher, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't read the
They have to be related back to Ashton Kutcher in one single coherent sentence.
I'm going to take that challenge.
Dan. As our presidential expert, one of the strangest ways we've covered in articles of something like this happening is election results and people's decisions on who to vote for being determined by really unrelated, kind of seemingly silly things. The election results on a Tuesday will be drastically affected by whether the home college football team in that city won on the previous Saturday, just based on the amount of dopamine that's like flowing through people's brains. And then there are all these presidential facts like you always vote for the tallest one, where it just seems like there are these arbitrary things that we're using to determine who becomes president. And presidents, at least at various points throughout history, have controlled the fate of the free world based on like their whims. Like, we had a lunatic in the office in the late 70s who decided that the best way to deal with China was by making them think that he was crazy and like willing to just fire nuclear weapons at them. He was like, yeah, that's where we're gonna bluff with my craziness.
Yeah, that was Nixon doing good cop bad cop without a good cop.
Yeah.
Just like, with just tell them, this is almost a direct quote. Tell them that Nixon is a crazy son of a bitch. Tell them that he's got his finger on the button and like no one can calm him down and that he's going to just bomb if you cross him the wrong way.
Speaking of careless presidential bombings, was this in a recent podcast where we heard that Truman...
That was a radio lab, I think.
That was a radio lab? Yeah. That Truman only found out about the second atomic bomb being dropped after the fact. And he was like, oh, stop bombing, guys. Yeah, like, almost like it was like he had forgotten to take the bomb order off.
Obviously, I think it's come down through history as like foggy or who can say for sure what was in his head. But there's reason to believe that he was taken aback when he learned a second nuclear bomb had been dropped. Like, there's reason to believe that that could have been a case of like, oh, wait, oh.
You didn't get the nuance.
It was
nuance.
A range of icy. Right. Oh, I meant, but if one, then not two.
Right.
But that didn't make it down the chain, and so they just dropped as many as they had to drop.
Yeah, he like gave the order like 5 days before
and
the first one was
crazy
dropped.
Is he didn't even say, bomb Nagasaki on this date. The orders were like, attack some number of targets on some range of dates.
That here's the window where one could drop a bomb and attack.
And here's a top 10 list of cities that like we think are attackable.
That's exactly right. Yeah. They passed one city because there was cloud cover that day and they were
butterflies
not
spared that town.
Exactly. But that is crazy. Like, the fact that if he hadn't intended for a second city to be bombed, it was like really the nuances of the conversation that he had at the point of like
making that command 10 days earlier. Yeah, it's as simple as like a misunderstanding that can happen around any office where you're like, oh, I thought you meant that report and that report. Oh no, just collate that whole shebang. Can you tell I haven't worked in an office very much? But
in this case,
that small or series of several small conversations decided millions of lives.
Yeah. I mean, like, wiped literally hundreds of thousands of lives out in an instant, like in a flash.
And arguably, that segues, unless we have more president stuff we want to drop.
We'll give Dan
right
some
now.
Time to do some research if you have a clean segue.
It's a really nice segue into something we've covered a little on the site, but it really captivated me, is how much we fear atomic power. And the fact that statistically, nuclear power could and should, in spite of things like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, yes, there have been horrible things that happen due to nuclear power. Statistically, it's one of the safest forms of power, especially if you grant that global warming is happening, then nuclear should be a cornerstone of our varied sources of renewable energy that we're working with. But partly, I think, because of the horror of Nagasaki and Hiroshima and the advent of the nuclear weapon, you can trace this whole feedback loop of pop culture affecting consciousness of the public and back and forth. Because, like, as soon as the A-bomb was invented, it became so popular that it almost immediately became cliched as a sci-fi author to write a short story about the bombs all fall or something, something atomic bombs or you guys, oh my God, atomic bombs.
Right.
And that became such a trope that it persisted into 50s and 60s movies where almost every, I mean, all our comic heroes in the early days, it's because of nuclear radiation. We believe that nuclear radiation just mutates you into monsters.
Right.
Movies were like, hey, this woman got irradiated, now she's 50 feet tall, and we fear that because of other sexism sublimation issues.
Yeah.
That we can
so let's just
later.
Go through real quick. So what are the movies that you're talking about with the all the bombs fall? Is that,
well, I'm more talking about classic sci-fi short stories. Like right after the bomb was invented, it became one of the most popular topics. The Onion, they have that book Our Dumb Century.
Yeah.
They have a great article called 60 Sci-Fi Authors Get the A-Bomb, and like they refuse to give it up.
Right.
Like, no,
yeah,
we're gonna use it constantly. We're gonna bomb the world thousands of times over.
Right.
Everything will be a barren, ash-swept, post-apocalyptic landscape. And I just don't think that idea before the A-bomb was, obviously every human understands mortality and can imagine like what if everyone was dead but me, but I really don't think it nestled into our pop culture consciousness in such a huge way until we created the real life technology that proved it, that was like, oh, we could do that, there
right.
could be a nuclear war, and now we can, we should really start thinking about and telling stories within that context. And I think now in this modern era, that's created the part that we've covered on the site is people are scared of nuclear fear on just a gut level. They're like, oh, that's that thing that blows up and everyone becomes a giant ant. Like, I don't want that. It's really hindered that industry. And from all statistical points of view, it would be great if we had more nuclear power in the world. But
right.
no one wants it. Like,
right.
no one will put it yeah. near them or their children or anything.
It's just had such bad PR and branding for the last.
Right, but it's better
decades.
Than coal, it's yeah. better than oil from a lot of different perspectives.
Like, all throughout Eastern Europe, there's yeah. these amusement parks that are, like, built around abandoned, like, nuclear things and stuff. Yeah, they're like the modern-day ghost towns, nuclear facilities. Everyone's just abandoning them.
Yeah. And Homer
for
Simpson.
Really, no great reason.
Homer Simpson, like, being the first thing you think of when you think of like nuclear safety, has probably set them back as
yeah.
well.
Right. Well, and the earthquakes in Japan definitely didn't help.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure the reporting on that was overblown. Like, I remember.
Haven't we covered that Chernobyl also was a tragedy, but it was made more of than is factually accurate? Like, at the time,
I think
news
Three Mile Island.
Three Mile
that's
Island.
True. Chernobyl,
no one will set foot here for 1,000 years, and that's
Chernobyl. People
true.
Had flesh milk falling
yeah.
off their bone. Like,
well, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I wonder what the first fictional representation of radiation making engianting something, embiggening something was. Dan, have you come up with any presidents who were elected on a whim?
Chester A. Arthur, he was someone who wanted to work with party bosses and political machines back when we had so much corruption.
I want
to
work with party
these...
bosses. That sounds sick.
That's your official title, isn't
yeah.
it? Don't you
party
demand
boss.
Party boss?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just these like Tammany Hall and Boss Tweed, these people who would collect all this money from their employees and use that to basically make presidents. They're sort of like the Koch brothers today, if you believe that dark money is deciding elections, as some do. These party bosses really determined who was going to actually be president because money controls everything. That's what Arthur wanted to be. He wanted to work in the New York Customs House, which is like a hub for party bosses, and just collect money and then use that money to fund political campaigns and like forced all of his employees to poll for the candidates he wanted to win. That was what his whole thing was. He wants power with no accountability, lots of money, lots of prestige, lots of clout. And he was found out and disgraced from that office while presidents were trying to wipe out corruption. And he was so pissed that he didn't, not that it was clear that he was a bad guy, he just was mad that he didn't get to go to all the cool parties anymore. And he didn't have that kind of, he didn't command that respect or presence. And so he thought, well, what's another job that has a lot of really cool clout but no actual responsibilities? And that's the vice presidency. And he, which everyone like across the board agrees is a bullshit job until Dick Cheney sort of expanded its powers
right.
in some neat ways, I guess. So that's
allowed to shoot people in the face
right.
at will.
Arthur wanted that job because he's not good at many things, but he's good at convincing people to hire him for things. And even though he was not big in the party or anything and wasn't on anyone's radar, and there were a lot of other potential candidates for VP, in 24 hours in one building, he just shook enough hands and talked to enough people and convinced them. They were like, okay, I don't know why, but yeah, you're going to be our candidate for vice president. And then Garfield won. And then Garfield got shot by a madman, a guy named Charles Guiteau, who thought he like wrote a letter and gave a speech in favor of Garfield to no one. He was a crazy person, a librarian turned lawyer turned preacher turned assassin. And he thought, if I give this speech and Garfield wins, then he'll own me and he will make me ambassador to France, which wasn't a position at the time. Guiteau saw Garfield in a train station and said, hey, it's me. I will accept my position as ambassador to France now. And Garfield was like, you're crazy. You're mad as a hatter. And he turned away. And Charles Guiteau shot him. And I think something like 80 days later, maybe, he died. And then Arthur was just suddenly president. And it was just like, oh, shit, this was never supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Frank Underwood meets Dave.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, he used all of his power and clout to get a position that he's in over his head.
Right.
It ended up being a pretty cool thing because Arthur, even though he was legit a bad guy his whole life, once he was president, splashed water on his face and woke up and was like, this is a really serious job.
All right, okay, Chuck, get your shit together.
I'm gonna wipe out all that corruption that got me here. And he did.
So there's this new show, I think on Amazon, based on the Philip K. Dick novel, Man in the High Castle, that's based on the thought experiment. What if the Nazis had won? What if the Allies had lost World War II? And there's been, I think, a lot of literature that's sort of based on that what if.
Harry Turtledove does really good, almost exclusively writes alternate history series where it's like, hey, what if the Civil War ended in a split that stayed split and there are two Americas? Now, how would everything else in history happen?
Right. So one what if I've never seen explored that seems like it could have probably the most easily gone in the most other way is the Mayflower landing in Plymouth. So first of all, the Mayflower was supposed to land in New York. That's where they were going for. Storm swept them off course. They find themselves up north and they're like, ah, shit, let's
fucking
get down to New York.
Butterflies, yeah, everywhere.
But the second thing that happens is they run out of beer. Beer being...
Well, that one's on me. I'm sorry.
Beer being the only thing you could really drink at sea because the water would go bad or whatever. no, but I think that's true. Like, that's why everybody was just shit-faced constantly. So I'm sure that they say the weather threw them off, but everybody was bombed. They're like, ah, man, this some weather, huh? But anyways, so they end up in Massachusetts and run out of beer, and they're like, shit, we've got to like make camp here in this like fucking craggy hinterland. But they also happen to hit the jackpot because Plymouth, as we've covered on the site and on this podcast, had just been completely cleared of all Native Americans by the plague that had like swept through. So they land in this town that has already been built.
It's just,
and like,
set up.
They're like, well, I'm gonna take the nice house, you take that house.
I hope all of America's like
right. This. There were like fields full of corn that had been planted. They're like, well, I'll be. And, you know, like a whole fishing area.
And they
like
took it as God's approval that they should slaughter everything between this ocean and the next ocean over.
So that specific group of people who happened on that specific already set up land, those people still are like the richest people in America, and like
their descendants.
Their descendants are like who have their names written in the halls of like Yale and Harvard and stuff like that. And there had to have been hundreds of people at that time coming over to America, because it's a thing that like I had always skipped over in my mind that there were 100 years from Columbus coming over to the pilgrims
getting going.
Yeah, like, actually like being able to settle things because all the Indians had died off. And so it was like this one boat full of people that was like blown all over the Atlantic Ocean lands in this one spot that's like actually good to settle in. There's probably 100 other ships that made land that year that didn't last. You know, Jamestown is one example.
As we're well aware, without the help of the native peoples, most of the pilgrims suck balls at settling. So
well,
without
Jamestown
that town,
a,
it's yeah. a, I don't see that they would have held
Jamestown
together.
Settled around that time, I think a little bit earlier, and they pissed off the natives, and the natives were like, no, man, like, we're not going to help you. And they all died off and like died eating their shoes and horses.
They died as they lived.
Yeah, one thing you got to say for those sons of bitches. But so much of our country's heritage kind of follows from this one random boat full of people who like accidentally drunk drove a boat like yeah. into the one place where like you can actually settle here because there's only
there's a 7-Eleven open
here. Right, there's only like terrified Native Americans all left right. over who are like, oh my god, what happened? Sure, I guess you're all there is. Yeah. I'll show you how this place works.
They're almost like the mythical amphibian, half mammal that first crawled out of the primordial ooze of white America.
Right. You know? Yeah, absolutely. And like
against all odds, they made it and just yeah. multiplied ad infinitum.
Yeah. There's people who still are in power, like in New England, and you know, everything kind of follows from there. And it's just completely
speaking
random
of,
drunk
oh,
driving.
Man. Oh, you got one? You
nope.
can shimmy in.
No, I'm just wondering what gets us from random drunk driving, what you're segueing
well,
to.
Well, I was going to say retroactively making order out of a bunch of random nonsense and yeah. calling it history. We've covered often in different ways that the Wild West period is complete and utter fabrication. But I think this is a good conversation to like collate all those points and think about them in order because it's this really long history of a particular delusion that I think shapes American values and culture a lot more than we give it credit for. Because the Wild West narrative is the original American narrative, arguably like the only white one at least. And it was all propaganda. It was given birth by these glorious paintings that people did that like hyperbolically show Yosemite Falls on steroids, looking way better than it really looks, even though it's one of the most spectacular things on earth. And those were paintings that were commissioned by the score as propaganda to get people to move west because no one was settling it in large enough numbers. And then as soon as they discover gold there, the legend of the gold rush basically brings everyone out and causes what we can tell from looking at historical records like a handful of bar fights. And then dozens of writers write books about these crazy bar fights and turn them into shootouts and invent the idea of cowboys who go around town dueling and shooting out. And all of that is bullshit, but it created this entire focus on the ideas of like being stoic, being ambitious, wanting to go out into an untamed wilderness and use violence to make your way, have your money, you have your herd, you defend it no matter what, you have a big bushy mustache, and that's like America, man.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. And I also think it really started, and arguably just the discovery of gold and it becoming an economic powerhouse, the West being an important focus. Before that, it was just East Coast all the way. There would have been no rap rivalry in the 1800s. Jay-Z just would have dominated.
Nas would have dominated.
Oh, no. Ooh. We got it. Can you cut that out and flip it, Engineer Brett?
Flip it so I say Jay-Z would have dominated?
Right, exactly.
I don't think we have that alter our voices. Technology.
But I just think on the site we've talked a lot about how the Wild West is nothing like you think it was. But I also think it's important to say deep down, isn't the Wild West what you think America is? And right. that's a really dangerous place to be.
And that gets at a good point. The chaos theory thing and the butterfly effect thing, it's sort of a way of looking at chaotic events and like ascribing a cause to one specific thing when you're like looking back at time. Like it's right. not even useful really, because is that what America was always destined to be? Because like still to this
For
day,
other
we
reasons,
still
right.
we still like to believe that men are having to win these gun battles. When we did an article about guns in America, we found that one of the most overreported stories is anytime someone fights a home intruder off with a gun. It happens incredibly rarely, but based on the news and the media, you would assume that it's like constantly happening all the time. Like there's been 3 gunfights in your neighborhood where somebody had to fight off an intruder with their handgun. So it's almost like, yeah, we can say it was those first liars who created that specific version of the Old West. Or is it just something was going to happen that was going to let us
totally.
Make up this version of
yeah.
the Old West?
Yeah, I'm just saying that they're an interesting link in the chain. And of course, yeah. like you said, everything splits off. Like, what was the butterfly? Because yeah. that could have been why the gold rush happened, but then you could say in another sense, the gold rush is why all the other shit happened, because
sure.
there's economic interest. But I thought that was really interesting about one that you had mentioned in the email leading up to this podcast, was the idea that a single Con Edison worker forgetting to flip a switch led to a mass massive New York-wide blackout, which led to looting, which is widely regarded as the first time the urban community had access to like record players en masse, and DJing and hip-hop was sort of invented based on that little microcosm of culture.
That's very spurious.
It's in a cracked article.
I know. I mean, it just seems to ignore rap specifically being born out of dirty Delta blues. I mean,
sure,
that's
the roots go back further.
Trey's very clear.
It actually,
tribute songs and like the kind of
When people like contradict that theory, they say that there was actually a great wave of Jamaican immigration, one of my favorite waves of Jamaican immigration, the greatest, and that there's like a lot of reggaeton dancehall sort of influences in early hip-hop that were coming in the late 60s, but the guys who are credited as being the first MCs who would rock a party, right, say, oh yeah, no, it was definitely the blackout. There's this quote from like one of the first DJs who's like, yeah, he invented the sound of like scratching on the record, who he was like, yeah, it was like Christmas for black people. We like got all this equipment. It was great. And when I first heard, I think a white NPR person say
hip-hop was invented.
Yeah, say that, I was like, yee, geez, NPR, that might not be. But then like they interviewed the guy and we're not. So you're
But I think that's the point I'm getting at, is the chain is always infinite, right? And that is true. So like I had heard that story growing up, just that the blackout led to at least that era of hip hop in New York, but I didn't know the Con Edison switch flip part. And it really invites you to think that everything is a chain from everything, and it just sort of blows your mind. Like,
and it's insane that that Con Edison operator was a butterfly. It was like an experimental.
Well, they should not have put him in charge of that. So the full story is that lightning struck three times, three different surge protectors. So the system was overloaded. He had to like flip three switches in a certain order. He flipped them out of order. The whole grid shut down. New York City was thrown into darkness at a very tense time in the city. Like, the city was bankrupt and like everything was going to shit, and it started these riots. That there's a book, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, because the Yankees were in the World Series. It's when Reggie Jackson hit three home runs, and at that time there were like these large riots that were happening and looting was happening all over the place, and those people looting, somehow that equipment made its way down to the first DJs. And even though you're saying like it influenced hip-hop at that time, like the speed with which it went from like three DJs at parties like scratching on records to Public Enemy is like 8 years. So like they were incredibly influential, you know. Whatever decisions you make with, like, if you write the first three rap songs, the decisions you make, whether they be random or not, are going to like hugely influence whether Diddy has a career or like.
But it's like you're saying, technology and resources catch up to ideas that are in the ether, right? Like the phone was invented simultaneously by like four dozen guys, I think was the official tally. At the same time, just because the pieces all existed and the technology, so I just feel like, yeah, everyone's right. Dan is right. I understand that there were African tribes.
No, I actually bow to Jack. I think I misspoke, because I was speaking specifically of rap, which very clearly has the American version of rap
culture
has birthplaces in blues and Mississippi. But speaking specifically about hip hop, which is rap, MC, DJ, graffiti, and breakdancing, that probably is directly tied to the blackout.
That's true. But if you're just talking about like rhyming couplets in a percussive way, you can trace it back thousands of years.
My name's Big Dan, and I'm here to say I'm gonna
rhyme things in a percussive way.
My favorite rap.
So glad we were recording that. Time and time again, I gotta turn back around and tell these hoes that I am the H and I see bitch, that's just the way it goes. I be on that shit that I had you on that I don't want no more. At this time, I need all my freak hoes to get down on the floor. Folks, as I talk to you here, Valentine's Day is, you might want to sit down for this, canceled. No, just kidding, not canceled. 5 days away. Now, you're going to want to take whatever you're sitting down on, flip it over, and light it on fire if you haven't gotten a gift yet. But don't do that, because me and ProFlowers have got your back. ProFlowers makes it easy to take care of your gift wherever you are, right now. So what you're going to want to do is go to ProFlowers.com, click on the blue microphone in the corner, and enter our code, which is CRACKED. That's ProFlowers.com, blue microphone, CRACKED.
You can get 2 dozen assorted roses, decadent chocolates, all for $29.99. You can upgrade to 2 dozen long stem roses, chocolates, plus an upgraded cherry vase for only $9.99 more. And that is fancy. So stop leaving it to the last second and creating bad stress in your life. Take care of your man or your woman with proflowers.com. Offer code CRACKED today. And do order today because this deal expires Wednesday at midnight. Hey guys, if you saw the Super Bowl last week, which of course you did, you saw that commercial for dreamingwithjeff.com, right? I imagine it made kind of an impression on you. It certainly made one on me. It was the one where Jeff Bridges looms over a sleeping couple going, "Om." And it would have been kind of creepy if it were anyone but Jeff Bridges, but it's the dude, so instead, it's just awesome. And Dreaming with Jeff is just a great site containing an album of relaxing sounds, guided meditations, and stories that you can listen to for free or pay what you want to download. All those stories, by the way, are told and spoken and owned by Jeff Bridges. And all proceeds go to No Kid Hungry, so you can feel really good about it. And the creator of that website did it all with Squarespace. Oh, who, look at that, is sponsoring our show today. Wow, that worked out well. If you're inspired by what the dude is abiding on the web, maybe it's a good time to go to squarespace.com and start building your own website. You can use it for your portfolio, personal site, and even store, since each site comes with free e-commerce option to make sure that those kids know hungry. You can start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. And when you decide to keep your website, enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off and show your support for the show. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. I was trying to rack my brain for examples of things that really seem almost completely arbitrary, that the random tiny thing actually is the reason that things turned out the way they were. It wasn't just like, oh, we were all waiting for that to happen.
Okay, well, let me go do research for a couple hours and I'll have a new list of stuff to talk about.
So there's this guy who's pretty much forgotten now, but was hugely popular. He was an explorer named John Mandeville. Back when Christopher Columbus and like Marco Polo were children, he was the explorer who was out finding all these incredible...
They had his action figure growing
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Yeah. And his book was like the thing that was most in print in Europe. And he gave rise to this huge generation of explorers, including Marco Polo and Columbus. So let's focus on those two. Columbus, obviously, it was hugely influential that he had a career.
Well danced around. One of history's greatest monsters.
Right. And Polo had a career that was closer to Mandeville because he went all around the world and saw all these incredible, fantastical things. Another thing I'm dancing around is that all of these guys were fucking liars. Mandeville came back with these stories of this pygmy tribe that had no head and just a little hole at the top of their neck.
Their face was on top of their body and they just had one big foot at the bottom.
Right,
and random nonsense.
So this guy just being a fantastical liar made people more likely to go out and explore. Yeah. You know, they're like, oh shit.
What I love is you can find articles from that time where there's drawings of the pygmy people with just one giant pseudopod foot on the bottom, but also a giraffe. And you can find people criticizing like, this is all nonsense. These are equally nonsensical.
Right.
It's just interesting to think that also the giraffe people are like, that's just as much bullshit.
Right. Yeah. Who found the Cape of Good Hope? Was it Magellan? Was another person from that era who was influenced by him. And also like his imagination was supposedly at the bottom of South America when he was discovering the Cape of Good Hope. They found these giants who like just were throwing dirt on their head and they were called the Patagonian people because that means giant in some language and like we still call it Patagonia to this day, and we still when we want to be like, hey, nice job navigating Magellan, that's like our term for good navigator.
See, I feel like we could program stuff like that into the Mars rover to make it more interesting, like it occasionally sends back like, also I met a race of kind aqua people.
Right. Columbus, by the way, came back with tales of mermaids which historians
which
have decided
he slaughtered.
Right. Historians think that they were manatees that he just you know, being at sea for that long makes a man like very lonely.
No, yeah. They existed before. First mermaids were mentioned in...
Dan thinks mermaids exist, though.
Assyria.
Yeah, no, when he saw them, he was like, they're not half as pretty as they are in paintings. He was like, man, these mermaids are real ugly.
He saw them, but he was just like, that's a pretty dog ugly mermaid. Yeah.
I don't know, I've been at sea for so long. Right.
That's what historians say. And
they're never wrong.
Yeah, makes him seem profoundly desperate and horny from from life at
Well,
sea.
Did he say I tapped that mermaid ass? I don't think he
it's
claimed.
Just
there are even hairy four-legged mermaids that bark on land.
but it's funny that like the idea that you would imprint naked pretty female on top of a fucking
what looks like
manatee,
a shaved orangutan.
What looks like this sea creature version of Walter Matthau, and he's like, yeah, there she is. But on the Polo side, so Polo was a total fucking liar. And one of the lies he told was based on this legend that had started from a single letter that had been passed around. It was sort of like the Middle Age equivalent of an email forward. It was a letter from the East, from a kingdom run by a guy named Prester John. The idea was that there was a Christian kingdom out there, out east, that was like full of jewels, and like he had like conquered
the east.
And he
just needed you to send him your social security number so he could put it in trust while you, yeah.
Yeah, no, and he was asking for people to come help him fight off the hordes. So it was like clearly a scam. But
yeah, it's exactly the history equivalent of the Nigerian prince email.
Yeah.
I'm sure like half the population was like, "Yeah, this sounds kind of crazy." Except Polo comes back and is like, "Nope, seen it. I've been there. There are diamond cups, boats of emerald. Everyone wears clothes that are made of gold. There are fish that walk on land. The men have horns, fairies, angels, talking birds," and everyone's like, well, he went there.
Yeah.
Polo seems like a stand-up guy. We're going to name that pool game after him. Yeah. Like, he's
a city of only cuckolds.
Right.
It's crazy that they've been playing Marco Polo the pool game before calling it that.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I have no idea how that game could have possibly
worked. Well, it used
to
be called Swimming, I'm Here. And then they thought it needed a catch here.
So he confirms the existence of this Eastern Christian kingdom. And when Genghis Khan or Genghis or whatever the fuck, however you say it. Ashton Khan. Yeah, Genghis Khan was sweeping across Asia and Eastern Europe. Everyone was like, oh, it's just Prester John's, because he was like defeating Islamic empires as he went with like terrifying ease. And because they only conceived of things as Christian versus Islam.
Or not.
Right, yeah. Because it was like the Crusades. They were like, oh, it's just our guy finally helping with the Crusades from the East.
And we hear these mysterious rumors of a massive army.
Right.
Like, glad they're on our side.
And Marco Polo just sprints in the other direction.
Right.
Bad plan.
Yeah, well, one of their guys had been there and like told them all about it.
So it's the end, you guys. Fish are going to walk on land. People are going to grow horns. We're fucked.
So nobody was prepared for Khan to come and just like beat the shit out of them, and now one in every 200 people is descended Khan, from him. Yeah. And the only reason, by the way, that it's not more than that is because I think his dad died or something and he had to turn around. It was just like some random death, and he was like, all right, let's head back. I've had again, enough sex. Oh, and by the way, the original guy,
Mandeville,
historians now agree was just
did
not exist. He was the hero of a series of short stories. Like, there's just some
shrewd
writer
true?
Of fiction who invented him, and because everyone was so fucking dumb and gullible in history, everyone was like, oh man, this guy's the best. I want to be like him.
I will say our listeners at home should go to Wikipedia and look at John Mandeville, because the full portrait of him, it looks like he's standing on a surfboard and doing double gun fingers. Yeah. It's like the coolest fucking thing.
And he's got the Captain Crunch hat on.
Yeah. Yeah, he basically is Captain Crunch.
I really hope in 1,000 years it's revealed that Nick Cage was never real.
Yeah.
Like, he never existed.
Like, and he is our most influential
right?
person.
It was just Tom Green doing a Borat thing.
Right. Yeah.
Went on for a really
series
long time.
Of
actually
great magic.
Kind of works. When you hear the things that explorers claimed, you get the sense that like most of what we knew about the world when we were like going out and exploring and like making all these influential decisions was being invented by like whatever the town dimwit was saying after, like, oh, did you see mermaids? Did you see like a people with no heads? And like they're like, yeah, yeah, sure, buddy, like whatever. Like
2 bits of gander.
Yeah, it's like so dumb, the stuff that they came up with. Like it's just based on whatever the popular imagination is. I guess it's like that's what they had instead of science fiction.
Yeah.
They just didn't differentiate. So that invented our world.
Reality must have been so disappointing. Like, oh, I just got back from America. Were there like pygmies? No, it's Native Americans. They super hate us. Not fun. Yeah. It's like us, except they're mad and they're right.
Dude, mermaids? Yeah, fine. But, fuck it. Okay, they were mermaids. Yeah. They were ugly. Yeah. But
and they all asked about you. Yeah. I can't wait for you to come.
Buffalo? Not for long. Hurry up. You better get in on that. Speaking of sci-fi... Oh, I'm just segueing up a storm this episode.
Yeah. Speaking of storms.
We've already spoken about
We're going to bring a butterfly in and field calls. Finally hold his feet to the fire. Butterfly sons of bitches. So I don't know if this fits with the new slightly revised or maybe I misunderstood premise of the episode. But talking not necessarily about the arbitrariness, but just pop culture being way more influential than we give it credit for. So a small subset of pop culture being vastly influential.
Yeah, just anything tiny or stupid that is vastly influential.
And there's tons of...
I didn't change anything on you.
Right. I think everyone knows that science fiction often foretells technology. And I think in the same way as the phone invention example, science fiction is this great repository for brainstorms. You don't even need to be a scientist or fully understand what you're thinking about to posit, what about a box that does this? And real scientists can grow up reading that and a generation later either discard it as 99% of science fiction is forgotten by history as, well, that would be great, but that's fantasy. That's a box that we can't box. But some of the stuff, they're like, oh, submarine, eh? That's a good idea. Maybe, yeah, submarine. And so Jules Verne's submarine is a huge example, but I was just sort of doing a general sweep online of these, and there were some that I was not aware of that really profoundly blew my mind.
Wait, so just on Jules Verne.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Who's that? No. did his vision from like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, would you say that it influenced the design of submarines or like...
Well, so there's arguments to be made that it did, but the engineers who later invented submarines, I don't think, unless I've missed it anyway, if they're on record saying like, yep, I read 20,000 Leagues and I had the idea. I'm just arguing that even if it's not a direct influence, but some of these are that I'm going to get to,
sure,
it's sort of a sign of the times that that's the technology that's waiting to happen in everyone's consciousness.
Sure. And it actually makes sense to me just because we've covered on the site, one of the very first submarines that was used in war was used in the Civil War. Mm. And it was this little one-man contraption that like had a crank where your dick was.
Pedals, right?
Yeah, and pedals. Yeah. And like when you look at the illustration, it looks like one of the guys from the Cheers opening, like in like,
a coffin.
Yeah, in a little, no, but it's like a little circle.
It's tiny.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It almost looks like, I'm trying to think of what that movie is where like they're inside the wheel.
Whoa.
Sci-fi.
I don't
like
know.
It's just like one big wheel.
2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe. All right, sorry.
Butterfly effect.
But it's interesting to me that like somehow we got from this
Nautilus,
ridiculous version of submarines to the thing that we have now, which looks, I think, like how Verne had sort of conceived of it.
Hey, Verne, you working on submersibles there?
Yes, Ernest, Jesus. very important.
H.G. Wells, because he's from the same era, it's easy when you're in on the ground floor, but credited with inventing a bunch of stuff. The one I didn't know was he's the first person on the record to describe, or at least credited with describing, automatic doors in fiction, a door that you approach and it knows and it lets you in. Although his opened vertically, which I think
what
is...
What a fucking idiot.
I know, stupid inefficient, right? Really easy to jump to. No, horizontal's much better.
Yeah.
I'm super proud of, as a big Trekkie, both the original series and TNG have big hits to their name, and these are the ones that are corroborated. So the Motorola executive who's credited with starting the first cell phone technology focused department. Like, let's make this tiny phone that you can hold and go anywhere. He has said multiple times that it was from watching Star Trek the original series and seeing their device and being like, we got to do that. That's going to be a huge deal. Someone needs to do that.
Wait, where does walkie-talkies fall in the fucking timeline?
I don't know.
Because it seems like Star Trek was just doing walkie-talkies that looked like that ladies' razors.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to detract from the phone inspiring the cell phone. I'm just saying this guy has said that the idea of, you know, bouncing a signal into space and having a future phone that you can talk to anyone immediately was at least helped along by that concept.
And speaking of ladies' razors, wasn't the one that they used in Star Trek, they were just like, eh, grab that razor over there.
It was
something
like a razor. Just
it was like really half-assed. So you go from really half-assed decision on the set of a half-assed sci-fi show. Yeah. Like, Nimoy made up the live long and prosperous Vulcan
hand sign.
He was supposed to do the peace sign at first.
Really?
And then he was like,
I hope
kind of
lame.
Was
like, that's
yeah,
too stupid.
It was Nimoy who was like,
good.
Nah, let's try it this
way. It's highly illogical.
Right.
It's a really weird loop reading about the history of the walkie-talkie, because Motorola first came up with the walkie-talkie. Then, decades later, Star Trek did Star Trek, and they had those cell phones, and Motorola was like, that's a great idea. All credit goes to Star Trek. Let's make cell phones.
So again, you see this, I think something that's going to come out a lot in this podcast is the chain is always infinite if you go back, and we retroactively pick the chain that everyone agrees seems like right.
But I do just want to say, like, it's interesting because we take for granted that a walkie-talkie could then be turned into this massive invisible network that all phones are on and like able to connect.
Right. Even though they're fundamentally different, a walkie-talkie is a radio wave box you hold to your head.
Right. Like from one to the
space.
It's just interesting that guy was, he needed Star Trek's help to get from walkie-talkie to cell phones.
Yeah.
That suggests that
it's
like
a loop.
It
bounces. It
really
back
is like
forth.
Fiction. We need fiction to like guide us, to just like point us
or to bounce ideas off of.
Right. We need someone who is creative enough to invent something that doesn't exist yet and that no one can see coming. You know, that kind of speculative fiction where you need an engineer probably wasn't thinking walkie-talkies exist, phones exist, one day I will marry these two and they will be cell phones. But a sci-fi writer was like, this is probably how people would talk.
And he was drunk in his underwear when he made that decision.
No one is going to hold him accountable to that. Like,
he's trying to make $50 on a TV script.
He never has to figure out how it happens. He's just like, well, they do because it's the future. Shut up, Motorola.
What if it fits in your palm? How's that? Fine. Whatever.
But yeah, so then Next Generation, the successor series, is widely credited with being one of the first places to show tons of touchscreen iPad-like technology. And there are a lot of Apple engineers who have said, like, in meetings when we were working on the iPad, we would say stuff like, we want to make something that is as cool as Star Trek, or you feel like you're at the console of the Enterprise, you know?
Right, and it's clear, looking at where we are now, it's clear that we have a future, probably, where we're doing Minority Report and Tony Stark style. Computers are things that appear in front of you that you manipulate with your hands and you send them away.
Designers
and
have, production
They're
designers
doing it
now. On film have helped decide what version of the future we're actually going to get. What the people in the 50s imagined was the future is so passé, we won't make it come to pass because we don't want to live in like a cheesy world. But I feel like we do want to live in Apple meets Minority Report world. Yeah. Two more that I think are the best. Well, these are, you know, these are
awesome.
Quick. These are quick one-offs. But I thought this was the most amazing in the reverse way of clearly the internet, the idea for the internet, apparently is a no-brainer, and we were just waiting for the technology to finally make it happen, because I found a bunch of people all throughout history have described something that you're like, oh, that's the internet. They totally thought of the internet in like 1790. But my favorite were, there's a Mark Twain story that has a thing that's described as, you pick up your phone and you can talk to anyone in the world instantly and you can get data and information read to you. And he called it the telelectroscope. And later, Arthur C. Clarke had a system that was very similar where computers could all talk to each other in a localized network, but he called it Dial-F for Frankenstein, because of course, one of the first stories describing a modern-esque internet is describing it rising up and destroying everything and killing everyone. Because that's also, I think, what fiction is for, to take something that was newly invented and be like, aren't you worried about this that could happen?
Right. We were just talking about this in an after-hours meeting about Michael Crichton, who has written so much sci-fi and speculative fiction, but it always to a book seems to conclude with, and anyway, that's why it's a bad idea to do this incredibly bold and exciting thing.
He only writes Pandora's Box.
Right. It's, hey, what if there was some way we could bring back dinosaurs? Well, you shouldn't. It's a bad idea. Hey, cell phone just came out. Here's a book where they kill you, every single one of you.
Hey, nanotechnology is going to cure cancer in the future. Oh, bad move, dude. You don't want that.
Which is really weird because he had medical training. He went to medical school, saw that all this amazing technology saves people's lives, and was like, nah, I'm a little...
One of his early novels is called Terminal Man, about they invent some life-saving medical procedure that can save people who are terminally ill, and it turns him into a crazy psycho murderer. So, it's always, don't go down that road there. And that was what's great. I think Crichton is to be credited for that. We talk about almost every creator repeats the same themes, and that's part of the reason we can keep doing After Hours, because we can pull those out. But Crichton's must be doing something right, because I never noticed. It took this recent conversation for me to go, oh, yeah, they're all Jurassic Park.
I really hope that even when he was a physician, he was just screaming the whole time, using the paddles to bring someone back to life, and just freaked out.
At what cost?
Yeah, thank you for saving me. Yeah, I mean, I guess right now.
He's like, monster, kill it.
A scalpel can heal, a scalpel can cut. Right. Such is life.
I feel like Crichton was extremely of his time. He was the most late 80s, early 90s idea creator. And I think there's been a shift since then that we're not scared of technology anymore. I wonder if Jurassic Park had been conceived today by J.J. Abrams, if it wouldn't have been this worked out great. Great park opening.
It's really interesting because it could be argued that we should be a little bit more scared, because we just had that hacker scare around The Interview a few months ago, and everyone and all those Sony emails were leaked, and there was all these very impotent threats about our citadels being demolished from hackers.
Not our citadel.
All right, guys, let's not fucking taunt the hackers. They're very powerful. We don't hack us.
Then that hacking movie came out, Black Hat, and it seemed like the most timely thing in the world, because it was about this computer warfare, and they had to get the best hacker in the world, who was in prison, who also knows how to fight,
to de-hack,
to go and hack what can't be hacked. And no one gave a shit about that movie.
Yeah, it was Chris Hemsworth as a computer hacker.
Interestingly, though, in quick succession,
as
this
the
year,
best computer hacker,
and Michael Mann, by the way, one of my favorite filmmakers. So,
step the fuck off.
No, I should have cared more.
Right. That should have been a movie. When the hacking scandal happened, he probably just thought, "This is the best
done deal
lineup of events in the world. I couldn't have planned this better if I'd hacked it myself." And
ooh, good conspiracy theory. So
it was all to launch Michael Mann's Black Hat.
They gave him the keys to the Sony building. Shouldn't have done that. That's how I think hacking works, by the way. Make a copy of the key. Get in the back door. It's a back door, right?
Michael
Mann,
here's a key. You're not going to hack us, right? Oh, no, definitely not. No.
Just going back to Twain's
telelectroscope.
Telelectroscope.
So a telephone that uses electricity to let you see far across the world. It makes some kind of sense.
Well, there's a lot, internet was predicted, but there was another one at, I think, early 20th century where they basically nailed that you'll wake up and check your morning paper on your amazing handheld computer device, and illustrated it looking exactly like the iPad, but they were and it will be delivered to your house every morning.
Disposable.
It's why? Yeah, why would that?
Yeah, sci-fi always gets one thing really right, and then fills in the blanks with stuff that they don't fully... They're not engineers, and they don't think about the consumer ever.
Right, a movie where they have it's a newspaper on your iPad thing, but you still have to lick your finger to turn the page
on. Flip the page,
But Twain, just a good sort of humbling thing. He's the greatest wit in American history, and really smart guy who was the worst investor in the world and was kind of an amateur inventor, and always thought he had the next big idea, and it was a typewriter that's disposable. And
it dissolves in the bathtub.
A sandwich you can't eat.
It's about time.
But that's also kind of super endearing to me, that he was struggling his whole life. It's damn it.
As a side note, it's interesting. I agree that in the industrial era, we got a heightened fear of technology, and now we're almost over it. But at the same time, it's very recently that Stephen Hawking came out and said AI is the biggest existential threat to humanity. And I think it was this week, Microsoft felt the need to release an official press release saying, we disagree, there's nothing to fear, AI will not rise up and destroy humanity. And Bill Gates, no longer being affiliated with Microsoft, posted a rebuttal saying, I disagree with Microsoft, with all due respect, we should be very worried about AI rising up and destroying humanity. People really think about it.
That's a pretty big dream team of Bill Gates. You know, I think I'm going to side with Stephen Hawking on this one. Oh, okay, I'll put all my money in destroying AI then.
Yeah, or like, you want to vote Gates and Hawking or whoever runs Microsoft right now, who you don't even know?
Whomever just came out of nowhere to say, we have nothing to fear of AI. Everyone go back to sleep. Everything's
especially
fine.
Of all the people that just said stuff, they're the giant firm working on developing AI technology for sale. Yeah. So,
has anybody suggested anything? Like, I feel like we're at this point, this is actually more what last week's episode was about, but I feel like we're at this point where, okay, we're over it. Like, it's not going to be the Terminator. It's not going to be a liquid metal person who stabs us and then can imitate our voice because he needed to stab us to do that. But has anybody come up with, like, practical rules for the internet and, like, rules for AI? Like, I feel like nobody's, like,
I mean,
people are like, it's really bad, guys. Yeah. Watch out. But nobody's like coming up with practical things, because last week's episode was about just like how the internet is an asshole. And it's like, yeah, let's just like come up with some rules that like, oh, if you act like this, then like you get kicked off, because like nobody thinks that's good.
But how can you do that with something that's literally the most global, right? Cultures vary so widely. You could say advocating really oppressive treatment of women is grounds for being exiled from the internet. But there are cultures where, from a traditional American or Eurocentric point of view, it's totally misogynistic, but yet that's their culture, and there's some argument about whether you can go in and, you know, prime directive.
But I'm sure there's like some golden rule-esque rules that like could be put down, like a constitution of the internet. And yeah, that's fine. Like, you could have like a governing bot, like a Supreme Court.
Right.
That,
but
like,
we did decide things like that. Like, if you get a felony, which is this list of things, now you can't vote now. So there are things that are, I see what you're going for. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everyone's still in the phase where they're so overjoyed that the internet is this free thing that is a tap in their house, that everyone is definitely more on the side of freedom on the internet.
There are millions,
if they only vaguely know what that means.
There are millions and millions of people who nothing will mobilize them faster than the tiniest threat to total freedom on the internet. You can see it on Reddit every second, and even our comment section. I mean, we turned off the comments today for the first time in the history of the site on one article, as far as I know, and people took to the forums and they're upset about it, as far as like, I completely understand why you did it, but my voice needs to be heard in this very specific way, and you can't do this. This is the way of life. I wake up with this site every morning and I should be able to do this thing that I want. It's like,
it's my right to put my content on your site that you own and
look,
pay for.
Look, bro, we did this one thing this one time. I mean, bro, it could be a woman.
Yeah, it's usually a woman. That's who we're most concerned about. Women are always so abusive in our comment section. By the way, it's like our most popular article in 3 years.
Such a great one.
But okay, let's get back to the subject at hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can take us out of sci-fi and bring us into something real. I recently watched the entirety of Sons of Anarchy. There's so many rules to it, and there's this huge culture of bike gangs that in their world stretches all over the world and goes back forever and ever. You know, it's another thing sort of like the Wild West, where it's the last like lawless band of outlaws. We have this really romanticized idea of the biker outlaws that I, for a long time, assumed was real and always there, but it was completely invented by a shitty journalist not too long ago, a few decades ago, because they were, like, people who used to be associated with motorcycles were World War II vets who weren't really ready to get back to society or
you're saying that would be the image most people would pull?
Yeah, there was some sponsored motorcycle rally in Hollister, California that was incredibly peaceful, and it was like sanctioned, and everyone knew they were doing it, and a bunch of people with motorcycles just went through and had a very pleasant time, just drove through the town, except for maybe three or four idiots got drunk, got into a fight, and there was a single misdemeanor arrest, and that was it. It was reported wildly as riots. Horrible, the Hollister
riots. The shootout at the OK Corral.
Hollister motorcycle riots, and a guy from the San Francisco Chronicle went there to cover it. And when he learned, oh, there's just one misdemeanor and everything was pretty fine, that's a bad story. So he wrote up a fake story outlaw biker gangs who were just terrorizing the city. People who would come in, run into restaurants, and just start attacking people for no reason. These lawless monsters. And he even staged a picture. Like, he got a guy drunk, had him sit on a motorcycle with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and a bunch of smashed beer bottles on the ground, and took that picture and filed it with a story. And then it got picked up by Life, and it was just everywhere. Everyone was talking about this. Everyone was suddenly afraid of bikers. This, in turn, inspired the movie, The Wild One, starring Marlon Brando.
As soon as you get a movie, you are in culture.
Yeah. And then after that, people see the movie that was inspired by this fake story, and they're like, yeah, that's what I want to be. I want to be like one of those outlaw bikers. And that's like, now we have Hell's Angels. Now we have Sons of Anarchy. Now we have all these things and this whole cultural
idea. And now there are really biker gangs.
Now there really are biker gangs.
So it's not just that they created this fake image like the Cowboys thing. They created this fake image, thereby inventing that, like inciting people to go do that.
Right, inventing it in real life. And now these people who just assume because of the Wild One, they're like, oh yeah, we have this whole like heritage now. I'm part of a thing that's
It's the real life superheroes larger. Movement.
Yeah.
All over again,
We covered that in an article and had an example that worked in the reverse direction, that the idea that mafia was like all about family and just the
honor
whole,
among thieves.
Right. The whole idea that we have today of the mafia was invented by Mario Puzo in the novel The Godfather. He didn't base that on anything other than like sort of a misunderstanding of an idea among the Sicilian mafia.
Now, you're saying the mafia did exist as a thing before
Godfather,
right?
Yeah. There was organized
it was
crime.
Basically like a more of a disorganized street gang like we would just expect to have.
The FBI, like the way that we think of gangs today, like modern inner city gangs, as, you know, not necessarily being, you know,
as opposed to a strict hierarchy with a consigliere and all this.
Right,
nonsense.
And all these rules like, oh, we do kill these kinds of people, we don't kill these
if
kinds
you
of
get
people.
Kissed on the cheek, it means you have 4 days to
we
live.
We don't deal drugs. We only do like this type of family, you know. And then Saturday Night Fever, which, you know, disco like came and went, but that was also invented by a journalist on a slow news day for New York Magazine.
Yeah.
It was like there were disco dancing, but it looked nothing like the thing that came out in his article. And it was like an illustrated article. So it was like, oh, like
didn't
this?
Didn't even need to pose a photo.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they made Saturday Night Fever, and then everyone said, oh, that's what the 70s were.
Let's join a biker gang to destroy this bullshit. Yeah, I feel like news is its own kind of echo chamber, kind of like we were talking about with fiction or movies or sci-fi or what have you. Because as we've covered before, news feels no compulsion to be statistically representative. It seems to me that no news organization ever sits down and thinks, oh, we heard this story about an armed man killing a home intruder who invaded his house. Should we decide how many minutes of airtime to spend on that story relative to how important that story actually is to what's going on in the world or nation or whatever your purview is? No. It's just whether that is a timely story. Even if you're a great news organization, all you care is that it's accurate. You don't necessarily think about how are we affecting culture in that micro of a way, but you totally do. Because like you were saying in a recent episode of the podcast, I think, Dade County, Florida is not a particular hotbed for wacky, crazy criminals, but because police reporting rules are different there, everyone thinks it is because that's what the news happens to report there a lot because it's a popular kind of story that became a trope in that community. In Dade County, Florida, you're used to opening up your paper and seeing a wacky criminal doing something dumb. And so news constantly, I think, does this thing where without even trying, almost blindly, the whole cultural stew makes us care about, let's say, school shootings right now. So the news covers school shootings because they're trying to reflect what people today care about. And then for a while, you have this feedback loop where it's like, everything's about disco, everything's about school shootings. And it sort of has to, I equate those in my head, equally terrible. Everything has to work its way through the system and out of the system. And you sort of see an arc of things being relevant.
Yeah, we went through that with Birdmageddon a couple years ago. Does everybody remember when that was a thing?
I was
that
scared
was
of birds.
Because there was like a bunch of birds died mysteriously one day. And everyone was talking about that story. And then another day went by and like, now these other birds died in Arkansas in a totally different state. And now there's birds who are dead in Norway. And now the fish died in Louisiana. That's something, huh? What does this all mean? And everyone was trying to piece it together. Why is all this happening right now? And the truth is that it's always happening everywhere all the time.
Ever since there's been parking lots.
We only know about it now because stories about birds dying in groups gets clicks and gets ad revenue.
It caught on in a concentrated way at one time. So now it feels real.
Yeah.
Right. Even though, like, you know, a month goes by and you dig into those stories, it's like, oh yeah, well, these birds died because there were fireworks, and these birds died because of noise pollution, and these birds died because they just come here to die. That's just what birds do. And they did it last year, too. They do it all the time. You just didn't give a shit last year because you were all about Pogs or whatever it was.
Right.
All the news was Pogs news. I remember
like
that.
2 years ago when that guy went on bath salts and ate somebody's face, that also happened to be the same month that we were reporting on a person who cut open his stomach and threw his intestines at the police. And
did you have to mime it at my face?
Someone who like cooked and ate their neighbor or something like that. These are stories that unfortunately are happening often.
It's like, what's the stat? Like 12 times a minute someone eats someone's face.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
No, but like crazy homeless person on homeless person crime is not typically hot news. Like, that's the guy who ate the other guy. Those were two homeless guys like, who were on crazy
great
drugs.
Movie, once, the guy who ate the other
and
guy.
And once the initial one picks up and everyone's like, oh my God, maybe there's a zombie outbreak because this guy ate this other guy's face, you just imagine blog publishers or newspaper publishers just saying, okay, you know what's really hot right now is anything that I can link to zombieism and this thing because everyone is hungry for zombie content, so find me something. Okay, there's a homeless man in Tuscaloosa who ate his wife's finger.
Yeah.
And it was like, all right, good, run it. Say it's part two of the zombie epidemic. And these stories just go through this loop.
Right, and if you're a young screenwriter and you happen to see a sequence of those stories in quick succession at the right age, who's to say you won't grow up and write a movie or, you know, grow up and write Easy Rider, like you said.
Yeah. Well, that's...
You see that news story that's total bullshit. Your job is to be a storyteller, not a fact finder. You write Easy Rider, and now it's your fault that Altamont happened.
Right. But like earlier, we mentioned the fact that five different people invented the telephone, brought it to the same World's Fair as Alexander Bell Graham, some people call him. And I think that they all probably saw the same World's Fair 15 years ago when they were 5 years old and like had the same idea stewing in their head based on this like
the telegram,
one idea that
right,
like ripples.
Whatever, yeah.
They got an idea, a little candle went above their head.
Right. Exactly. There's this new series on NPR called Invisibilia, and they were talking about this idea that, so humans have these things called mirror neurons that it's almost like ideas have a mass to them. You can't help but pick up my mood. You can't like when we're in the same room.
Both subconscious body language, but also literally electromagnetic fields from your brain that they've measured, right?
No, just like subconscious body language. Yeah,
just cold reading?
Just sort of we're incredibly influenced by people's expressions, body language,
more so
facial expressions,
the
words they use. I think we covered on this show before how quicksand became this sort of image because it was like a really easy special effect to pull off in the early days of movie. Like the first time it was used was a 1909 silent film. Because, okay, we've pretended to shoot each other enough. Like, what's a cooler way we can pretend to die? What if I'm, like, falling into the earth? Like, you know, like, it's got to be one of the easier special effects to do. But it kept building and building and becoming a bigger and bigger trope to the point that during the 60s, it took over. It was like one of the main sort of set pieces of Lawrence of Arabia, which won the Oscars.
If you were on an island, a desert, or a jungle, you had to at some point either watch out for or run afoul of quicksand.
Right. Every single video game we had growing up, there was quicksand to contend with.
Yeah, and I think it still shows up in video games because that's the bottom
here and there.
The
there's
spit
a
bucket of culture.
There's a lag time, but hey.
No, I'm joking.
But it is even phasing out of video games by and large.
It also spread into one of the questions that someone asked Neil Armstrong when talking about his plans to land on the moon was, well, what if you get out and it's a quicksand?
It's all just quicksand.
And like Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, the I Have a Dream speech, we don't call it this because quicksand is no longer cool, but he talked about freeing America from racial quicksand. And today we like call the Iraq War a quagmire during Vietnam.
We moved on to swamp imagery instead of desert imagery.
But Vietnam was quicksand. That was the only thing you heard it referred to during the 60s. And then people were like kind of over it.
What was Neil Armstrong's response, by the way? Was he like, well, now?
Oh my God.
I wasn't before.
Yeah.
I guess I'll have to wear some big suit or some shit.
It is really interesting. We think that we're more in control of the thoughts in our head than I think we really are. I think ideas are much easier to catch and like sort of pass on. Like memes pass through us the way viruses do.
Well, and it's been proven in countless sociology studies that like one of the main ways as you're growing up from baby age and dating back to caveman times that you show someone, hey, I'm part of your group, or hey, don't kill me or steal my food so I starve to death, is simple mirroring. Act like the people around you, and they'll tend to be happy with, oh, I see, you fit in here. we're not going to expel you because you're dangerous. And people are idiots if they don't think that that extends to today. We still have caveman brains. And there is a strong compulsion, unless you know for a fact that it's like a fact and they're just wrong, to go like, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. I didn't hear about that. But quicksand, wow, who knew?
Another thing I mentioned on last week's episode is this idea that like you can have four people in a room and three of them are actors and they'll say that shorter line is actually longer and the fourth person will go with that just because there's just something inherent in us that supersedes logic that we will go with just based on like sort of mirroring and going along with what other people say.
I don't even need that many people or that many lines. Like I am such an agreeable person with strangers. We were a couple of weeks ago, a bunch of us were playing football and it had been drizzling. And Soren and I were talking to a guy we met afterwards, and he was like, you guys play football in the rain? I was like, yeah, it was fun, kind of slippery. And he was like, yeah, but it's cool, I bet. Yes, it's very cool. You know, when you hit the ground and, like, water just splashes up in the air. And I said, yeah, it's awesome. And Soren said, there actually wasn't enough water for that to happen, which was true. There wasn't enough water, but I was just like, I just wanted to agree with
that
stranger.
Guy's narrative.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, you're right. That was awesome. And you were there, and we had fun.
Priming. And if you look into behavioral psychology, it will like shake you to your core because it implies that it's almost iceberg like what you're saying, Jack, where most of it is under the surface and almost automatic. And there are neuroscience studies that back it up. But the idea that, so in that situation you described with the three actors, or they've done it with people watching Jeopardy clips and you can get them to think Alex Trebek is the smartest man in the world, even though they know logically he knows the answers because he has them written on a card. In that moment, that fourth person is still doing what you'd expect someone to do logically because they're still just weighing cost-benefit analysis in their brain. But their brain is telling them it's better to be liked and part of society by agreeing with the three people who came before than it is to be technically right about this issue because you're not going to get any reward or anything.
But I almost think that it's unconscious, and I think it's actually like sort of a separate system that has more to do with us being a part of an overall, like we're all part of this one organism, you know, like
an emotional vibe in the room that you don't want to disrupt unless you have strong reason to disrupt it.
I think there's something unique to us. So like in the first half of the 20th century, I don't think people were unaware of this. I think people wanted to be part of a group and paid attention to how the group was thinking and like ideas that they were getting from the group and just kind of went with it. Whereas now everybody wants to be unique. And so we're almost blind to that. We choose not to look at the fact that we just pick up people's ideas. People's ideas like have a tremendous influence
on
us.
But even your desire to be unique and independent or stand out from the crowd is a cultural bias that you got from fiction in part that you imbibed growing up. There are some cultures where being unique or standout is not the goal.
Sure.
So everything influences everything and it's always that loop, I feel
like. But I wonder if we're worse at recognizing when we're being influenced by other people today than we were at any time in the past, because I think there is something unique to that drive to like be unique in our culture.
We're unique in our uniqueness.
We're full of shit in our drive to be unique.
Right. We realize less now than ever before how influenced we are, you're saying. You're saying that in the past, it was more overt. Don't you want to be part of the cause? Don't you want to be part of the group? This is what everyone's doing. Don't you want to be part of it? And everyone said yes, and it was kind of bad to be unique, and they might have harbored, I want to break away from the mold kind of feelings, but they still knew this force is telling me to be a part of something, and I'm deciding that I want to be part of it. We still have those same forces as today. It's just not someone in a 1930s radio voice saying, don't you want to be
Chesterfield?
Yeah. Speaking of Sons of Anarchy, for instance, we had a photoplasty contest where we just asked our forum members to come up with the best idea for an ending, how you would end a TV show still going right now if they had the balls, how they should end it. And our forum member came up with an ending for Sons of Anarchy where Ron Perlman is just riding his motorcycle and you see reflected in his sunglasses like a truck. He's just driving right into a truck. Like, he's like, I'm going out like this. And a year and a half later, that's how the show ended. Now, I'm not suggesting that the writer...
You're in the middle of watching this, Dan?
It wasn't Ron Perlman who drove into a truck to kill himself at the end of the show.
Well, but Jack is cleverly trying to defuse spoilers.
It was Charlie Hunnam.
That's what
spoiled.
I was trying. Well, anyway, it was one of the characters, and we
and there was this pygmy tribe there with no heads.
So I'm not suggesting that the writer of that final episode got that idea from our contest, but ideas are like circulating around. It really is like a circuit of ideas passing through circuits of humanity, and they're just out there. They're being expressed. That writer, I'm sure, would be mortified if he saw that that exact idea had been called out in like a comedy website or something.
Fuck you, pay us.
Yeah,
it is exactly. Our concept, which we lifted from a forums member.
And like people are getting accused of plagiarism and art and stuff who, yeah. You know, it's just...
Right. That's a real fuzzy line. Where do your ideas come from? No one actually knows. So did you rip that off? Is it really... There's times where it's really clear, but most of the time it's like, well, what is ripping off?
Like Tom Petty has a co-writer credit on Sam Smith's Stay With Me Now as mandated by law because it was determined that Stay With Me had ripped off Won't Back Down. Mm. Which is something that I know both of those songs, and I never would have made that connection until AV Club is like, look, it's clear that they are similar in these ways. And Sam Smith lost that battle, but it's still at the same time, it's like, I don't know, maybe I don't know where any of the songs come from.
People probably get away with that all the time without you remembering what song they ripped off, you know?
Right. My oldest brother is a musician and composer who has scrapped so many songs because he realized after the fact, oh, you know, this is just Chim Chimity, Chim Chimity, Chim Chim Chiroo from Mary Poppins, because his songs for a musician come from somewhere you can't plan. It's somewhere in your head and from your experience, and you write it, and sometimes it's original, and sometimes it's, oh, you know what, that's right, it's this Chili Pepper song from the past, yeah. And I just hadn't realized that because it came from the exact same place. You're not opening a drawer or anything.
Your brother's a fan of nonsense lyrics, Chim yeah. Chimney and Chili Peppers.
You know what's driving me crazy lately is I'm binge-watching Friends like everyone who has Netflix, and I swear to gosh, every single sitcom sting that they used in that series, the first half of the sting is a clearly recognizable riff of a big hit song, and then they change it at the second half.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And they have all tortured me, and I keep suddenly going like, oh shit, Owner of a Lonely Heart by Yes. Like, yeah. I want to meet whoever composed all the stings for that show and be like, I know what you were doing. I could tell you were ripping this stuff off.
What's the craziest fucking thought we can put out there knowing that it will ripple out from here on?
Eternity.
Yeah. It has to be completely original.
Oh, does it? Yeah. Oh, okay. We haven't talked about the Freakonomics thesis yet, which I still think is the quintessential example
of
this. All
right, yeah, we should wind down. Let's get it all the
good
stuff.
Have we said the Freakonomics thing before?
What is it?
Well, just when Freakonomics came out, I think everyone has at least heard of that book. But the thing that really put it on the map was this exact thing. Like, oh, something arbitrary totally created this later and no one could have guessed. But
are you talking about the tipping point? Or
no. That's also about that.
Okay.
But Gladwell was involved in Freakonomics, I think.
No, it was similar. Yeah.
But the one in Freakonomics that maybe, Jack, tell me if this is the tipping point, but I was pretty sure this was Freakonomics, was the discovery that it seems very compelling that in the 80s, crime was going up and up and up and up. And there were a lot of concern about just statistically crime is steadily going up. And at this rate, by the time it's mid-90s, it's just going to be Escape from New York.
Yeah.
Like, we'll all have to leave.
All movies set in the future during the 80s. All movies
prison.
Set in the future where like the world was just fucking terrifying.
And in the same way that we're doing a lot of climate change movies now, I think in large part because people are old enough now to have grown up worrying about that as an existential threat, the big one in the 80s was crime, all these criminals.
Because crime was going up.
It was true,
yeah.
To some degree at least.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, it completely dropped off. And for a long time, people were just like, oh, well, thank God. We dug deep and we realized that we're good people, and I'm glad. But no one had a compelling theory. And the compelling theory that I think Freakonomics put forth, maybe I'm wrong and it's the tipping point.
They both put forth a theory.
Okay,
actually.
But regardless,
I think
the theory is that the reason that drop-off happened is because, like it or not, pro-choice or pro-life, Roe v. Wade decision happened in 1973, which was 18 years roughly prior to when you start seeing a precipitous drop in crime. And the idea being that if you're raised poor and deprived of resources, this is just true, you're more likely to commit crimes later in life. And people who are pregnant, who are very poor, are more likely to take the choice to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. So the fact that we allowed people for the first time to have abortions took a bunch of potential criminals out of the time stream.
The tipping point example is they started fighting petty crime during the early 90s. Giuliani like put cops on every corner, but also like removed all the broken windows and like started arresting people who would like skip
right.
And
that's,
so it was like a trickle up of
because
like,
it makes you feel when you live in this town, this is not the type of town where there are lots of crimes,
right?
So I shouldn't commit one.
Yeah,
if you're like on the fence about whether to go commit that crime.
Well, this town doesn't seem into it.
Yeah,
well, and as be a lawyer, I guess.
What else?
Stop buying pets just because a movie makes it popular.
Oh yeah,
we've covered that on the
Stop
site.
Buying owls.
But as a public service, never buy a pet because you saw it in a movie or read about it in a book, because you're just going to kill it later. You're part of the problem.
Okay, so this might be a good way to wrap it up, because I wonder how true that... Like, how many people fucking bought owls?
But after 101 Dalmatians came out, it really did. There was a huge spike. And same with Beagle was like the 50th most bought thing. And then after the Peanuts comic strip, it was number one for decades. And it was also the number one in number of dogs being put down at pounds. Jeez. Because everyone's like, hey, Merry Christmas, it's Snoopy. Oh, you didn't want a dog? Fine.
It was the yellow bird you wanted? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll just get rid of the dog then.
Oh, you wanted a small, bald child? Okay. Didn't realize.
But I was going to say that I think one of the most underrated small things that has a huge influence is just like whether the idea of a story fits well in a title on the internet. Because like I spend so much of my time doing the frustrating work of trying to come up with a title that's going to get the most clicks to our content while still expressing the idea within it. And like that's a change that's happened over the past 20 years that is really vast. Like it used to be that you would read a book or a magazine article just based on you subscribed to that magazine, you liked that magazine, or you knew that author, or
you trust the outlet.
Now it's just you're given like 60 characters to express the idea, and it's just random. It's just like however grabby those 60 characters are, that's what determines how an idea travels.
And literally without exception, the top comment is, I feel this title was totally unrelated to the content.
Yeah.
It's just a hard game to play.
And there, every once in a while, I'll find the truth. Like, I'll read a very incendiary title, click on the article, and realize, oh, they're kind of grasping at straws there, and they clarify they don't really mean that Tom Brady bit a hole in those footballs. That's just the title that they happen to use to be cheeky. But that's 1 out of 10 times where I'll click a title and read the article. There are plenty of other times where I'll see Kim Jong-un threatens to strangle James Franco with his hands, and I'll think, oh man, what a jerk. Ugh.
And not even read the article.
And not even read the article, which if you click on it might just say in a recent Onion article, you know?
And it's just crazy, you're right, Jack, how I think that's a history progressive thing, just as we have an overload of information. Remember when you used to read stuff based on being vaguely like interested because the title is mysterious? And I don't do that anymore. I read the back of the book, I go on Wikipedia, I read enough plot points, and I'm like, okay, it sounds good, I'll stop spoiling it. I'm willing to devote the time to reading this.
What's a book, you said?
It's like an ebook with if you're not on E.
But is it delivered to your house every morning like my iPad?
They're completely disposable. Yeah, you just throw them down the magic chute and the man comes and takes them away.
All right, that was our episode. Hope you enjoyed it. While you were listening to it, I thought of another example of something like the Heimlich maneuver that always seems to have existed, even though it's relatively recent and arbitrary and weird. On Never Not Funny with Jimmy Pardo and Matt Belknap, two of the funniest kind of good friends to eavesdrop on in the entire podcastosphere, they were talking about the Katy Perry Super Bowl halftime show, and their guest, a gentleman named Dave Holmes, who I spent the first 60 minutes picturing as Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall, making me wonder how many of the famous people on podcasts I listen to are actually totally different famous people than the ones I'm picturing. Anyhow, Dave Holmes, handsome gay former MTV VJ, not former member of Kids in the Hall, pointed out that the Super Bowl halftime show was mostly just the Grambling Marching Band until 1992, when the New Kids on the Block performed. Before that, it was like every other halftime show in sports, filler that gave people an excuse to go to the bathroom, and marching bands an excuse to exist. And they went through all of the Super Bowl halftime shows since then, and there really have only been like 5 that are the gigantic spectacle that all Super Bowl halftime shows are, in my mind. The one where Britney Spears came out with a tube sock on her arm, the controversial one where Justin Timberlake tore Janet Jackson's boob off, I think. I don't know. Everyone was really upset about that one. Anyways, the point is that some guy suggested in 1992 that they put a big high-tech concert on, the thing that seems so obvious to us today. And everyone in that boardroom laughed their ass off at that guy and told him he was a fool. Where's his movie, the underdog TV producer who suggested that they, I don't know, try to put something worth watching on TV in the middle of the most watched television event every single year? All right, on to footnotes. We played Blessings by Big Sean featuring Drake, and there's a Kanye verse at the end. Kanye keeps popping up here and there. Yeezy season approaching. We played Big Sean's verse, though. The second half of his first verse manages to cover a bunch of ideas we talked about today. The question of whether something's predetermined or a chaotic tangle of events and cause and effect. And also the idea of memes and words and ideas circulating beyond our own control and more than a person might want them to, especially a person talking shit behind Big Sean's back. And he also drops an Ed, Ed, and Eddie reference, and I don't know, I think I like Big Sean. I think I'm having to come to terms with that. We heard Kryptonite by the Purple Ribbon All-Stars, which was like a rap supergroup, I think, formed by Big Boy. This song has Killer Mike on it, though I don't think he was an official member of Purple Ribbon All-Stars, and I think I've played it on a spit take before, but it's just a fun song that you probably missed there, so great song to pretend to throw stuff in the air to. Speaking of confetti, as Big Sean was at the start of this episode. And it also starts with one of the Atlanta rappers from the Purple Ribbon All-Stars, I think Rock D was his name, complaining that time and time again he has to turn around and tell these hoes that he's the HNIC and that's just the way it goes, which has always sounded a lot like a weary school bus driver complaining about his job more than someone bragging about how awesome they are. Like, if you have to keep telling them how awesome you are, there might be a reason that that particular message is not taking. Rock D, person who could probably destroy me if he wanted to. It's just a funny lyric, and I love the song so much. I don't know why I'm talking shit about it. And we heard the song All My Friends by LCD Sound System. This is a slightly different take than you might have heard from the This Is Happening Deluxe Edition. It's from something called The London Session. It's old. It was a hit back in 2007. It got a bunch of think pieces written about it in Slate and everywhere and Pitchfork. But I think it has some thematic alignment you'll hear in there. And also because it seems like you guys, it's like usually the stuff I hear back from you about is old school rap songs or classic songs like this that I assumed everyone already knew about, but people are like, oh, thank you so much for introducing me to that. So I'm gonna try and include more just classics here and there, and this is just one of my favorite songs of all time. It's super long, so we won't get to play all of it, but we'll play you a nice sample so you get the idea and go out and buy some LCD Sound System music. And we're gonna ride out on that. Back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then. That's how it starts.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. The wolf dead.